Run on,
from the world famous rock studios in Los Angeles, it's Reign of Troy Radio, a USC football podcast.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Rot on God, episode 10. Looking back at Game of Thrones season 6 season finale called The Winds of Winter. If you're looking for USC football, we'll be back tomorrow with the new podcast to talk about the Trojans. But tonight, today, whenever you're listening to this, it's all Game of Thrones all the time. As always, follow us on Twitter at Reign of Troy. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Reign of Troy. Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud, soundcloud.com/Reign of Troy Radio. Phone number 213-373-1872. Email address is reignoftroy@fansided.com. I'm your host, Michael Castillo.
You've been sent from the future to destroy me because it's working. And I don't know my left butt cheek, my right butt cheek, but I believe in listening to both butt cheeks and then farting out my asshole mouth.
Jeez, Michael. Potty mouth.
Tell me that's Veep. That's Veep, right?
Oh, yeah. That's Amy from Veep.
Amy, she's my favorite. She is my favorite. And,
I haven't watched tonight. Did you watch tonight yet?
I have not. But yeah. I love me some Amy. I'm joined along with my co-host, the editor of Reign of Troy, Alicia Deratola.
Hello, everybody. I did not get that Veep reference, and I'm proud of it.
You would. And also, from What's Brewing Show, our good buddy, Jake Merrifield.
Hey, how you doing?
What an episode, you guys. What a freaking episode of Game of Thrones. Season six is all done. We have 13 episodes left. And, you know, one of the questions that, you know, before we jump into this that I want to throw out to you, going before the season, D&D, the two showrunners, David Benioff and the other dude that I can't remember the hell his name, but it's another D. One of the things they talked about was that when you get to the end of the season, you'll be able to see the finish line. And 13 episodes left, 7 next season, 6 the season after, and season 8. So right now, looking at Game of Thrones, looking at the plot lines, looking ahead, can you see the finish line, Alicia?
Yes, extremely clearly. In fact, I am predicting right here and now, I know exactly what next season is going to be about, and I know exactly why it's a 6-episode season, or 7, whatever it is, and then they split it into the next season, because the coming season is going to be sorting out this new Battle of the Kings that they've set up in this episode. And then once that's all dealt with, then the final season will be all White Walkers all day. So finish line, I see you. Yes.
Jake, do you agree? Do you see the finish line?
Yeah, you're searching for David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. And I agree wholeheartedly with Alicia that next season, the shortened season, will be all about what's going on south of the wall, and then the following will be what's going on with the north of the wall invaders.
All right, fair enough. I didn't necessarily see it in such a stark way, no pun intended, but I was thinking that, you know, the way you look at it now, with Daenerys sailing to Westeros, I thought next season would be about the ridding of the Lannisters. And that the season after that would be about the joint force going up against the White Walkers, which I guess is the same thing. It's the same thing, just worded a little bit differently. But
you're just picking your side there.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. But yeah, next season, hopefully we get to see more Euron Greyjoy, since we didn't get to see him. And hopefully we get to see more of the Hound. I mean, those are two characters that, you know, were brought into this season, and we barely saw any of it.
You bring up a good point, Michael, in that the Greyjoys are still out there. That's kind of unresolved. So you imagine there'll be a little bit of overlap in some Euron Greyjoy dealing with some of what's going on in the South, with and you're dealing with Yara and Theon. And then also, I'll bet you, or the way I look at it, and you can agree or disagree, I think that next year there'll be a lot of fighting between Dany and the Lannisters and Dorne, and possibly some Greyjoy action in there with Euron and Yara and Theon and all that. That'll all be one big jumbled mess. And I'm curious to see if Winterfell and the North actually gets involved with that, or they kind of split the story between what's going on in the South and then what's going on in the North. And then maybe the end of the season for next year builds into, you know, whoever's left over in the South, of course, it'll be Dany, I'm sure, in some way, shape, or form, joining up with, or, you know, getting Jon and Sansa to kind of bend the knee and join with them, and then dealing with the White Walkers in the following season.
I don't know. I mean, that sounds like an interesting thing going forward. It's going to be interesting to see how they put it all together. The shortened seasons are going to be fascinating. I hope they're longer episodes. I know that probably takes away the point of having a shortened season. But hey, if you're only going to give me 7 episodes next season, can you at least make them as long as this one was? This one
was
68 minutes, which, first of all, I am eating crow here. No pun intended again.
Jesus, Michael.
I know. I thought for sure that everyone was saying, 68 minutes is going to be the longest episode, blah, 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 blah. And I thought for sure that was going to include the credits, the previously on, and the inside the episode. And I'm like, that really means more like 58 minutes if you include all that stuff. Why is this a big deal? But no, this one, it was a full-on 68 minutes because the runtime on HBO Go was 72 minutes.
Yeah, definitely supersized.
I mean, not 72 minutes, 82 minutes. So yeah, I'm totally... I am totally cool with it. It was a great episode. It felt really meaty, and it delivered. It was finally, maybe for the first time since season one, where a season finale felt like a big season finale, because a lot of times the Game of Thrones season finales, they build up in episode 9. That's the penultimate episode in which everything happens, and episode 10 is just kind of the wrapper-upper, and this one was a wrapper-upper and a big deal at the same time, so that was super fun to go through. But let's start this episode recapping this podcast, or start this podcast recapping this episode, sorry. We want to start with some lighter stories, or not lighter stories, smaller ones, before we get to the big blow-ups that happen later. Pun definitely intended there. So let's start with the little girl.
Arya Stark.
The phrase.
Yes, let's start talking about the phrase. We see them twice, two scenes here. First one, Walder Frey and Jaime Lannister having a little bit of a discussion. And Alicia, what was your take on that discussion that they had, where Jaime was kind of being a dick to Walder Frey?
I thought it was setting something up, because clearly there's no point in being there in the first place if it's not setting something up. So I thought it was setting up some sort of discord between the Lannisters and the Freys. And obviously I was very wrong. And it made the reveal of what a certain Stark child does particularly great, because I had been blinded by my trying to figure out what Jaime was going to pull. But you know, it was a fun little scene with, you know, we got a little bit of a Bronn in there, which is always fun, and Jaime just being really salty, which I guess makes sense, since he's kind of at that point. He's kind of at the point where he's just like, "F the world." But I mean,
he's so done. Least, he's so done with Game of Thrones. He's so over it.
He's so over it. And it's gonna be really interesting next season when we see, like, just how over it is he gonna be, given the developments in King's Landing. But yeah, I find myself now watching all these episodes trying to, like, stay ahead of the storyline, like trying to guess what's going to happen. And this one faked me out, because the level of Jaime's annoyance made me think there was something else going on there. And there was, just not what I thought.
Yeah, I was very confused. This is the only part of the episode where I kind of was thrown for a little bit of a loop in the first, because it was broken up into two scenes. The first was Walder Frey and Jamie, and then the second one obviously was when, you know, Arya shows up. But when Jamie was there, I realized he was there. They're celebrating the banquet and all that stuff. And I really liked when Jamie was basically telling Walder that, you know, he's kind of irrelevant and he sucks and he's never battled before. I liked that dialogue. That was great. And of course, the stuff with Bronn was fantastic too, even though I'm sure Michael hated it because he's a dick. But it was really good to see Jamie kind of putting Frey in his place. But then when the scene goes away, was it clear to you guys that Jamie was leaving town at that point? Because that's in effect what he did.
Yeah, I thought he was leaving in a huff.
Yeah, I thought he was leaving in a huff, but then I kind of agree with you, Alicia, in that, you know, you were expecting if there was going to be a comeuppance, I was wondering, well, why would Jamie be the agent of that? Because even though, you know, he's part of all this, it really, you know, he shouldn't be the one that's going to take revenge on him. So I was kind of trying to put that together. But then as soon as they got to the next scene, and before she even said, you know, as soon as I think he said, you know, you're not from around here, or whatever he said, whatever Walder Frey said, then I was like, oh, that's Arya. And then, you know, you're just waiting for the great revenge scene. How quickly did you guys pick that up?
I was expecting this the whole way. I was expecting it the whole way, because I had it in my mind that Arya was going to kill Walder Frey to end the season. I just thought that was going to be the parting shot for the season. You know, last year we saw, you know, Jon laying in the snow. You know, the year before we saw Arya on that ship sailing to Braavos. I fully expected that it was going to be Arya standing over Walder Frey, and that's how it was going to end.
Yeah, no, and kudos to you, Michael,
so
for sniffing that out.
I fully expected this. So once she comes in, I knew it straight away. But let's talk about the awesomeness of Arya and the line of, "Where are my sons? They're already here, your lord. They're already here, my lord." Wasn't that just fantastic? And then she opens up the little meat pie, and there's a little toe.
Finger pie. Either way, it's disgusting. I should have caught on to it so much sooner, but I thought the looks between the girl and Jamie like meant she was a Lannister spy, and that was like a message from the Lannisters that his sons were in the meat pie. So like the whole way through, I'm still thinking like this is a Lannister plot, but I mean, it turned out to be much, much better than that. But the meat pie deal is so it's a great, like, I don't know if anyone who listens is a fan of South Park, but I just kept thinking of what Cartman did with the chili. And it was definitely one of those comeuppance revenge moments that just makes me giggle in a really disturbing way.
Definitely a good one. You know, and the one other thing I really liked about those two scenes was, you know, when Jamie was what really set Jamie off and caused him to kind of tell Walder Frey off was when Walder's like, yeah, you know, we Freys and we Lannisters, we really know how to, you know, we really know how to battle and take people apart and win the war and blah, 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 blah. And when Walder was saying we, Jamie really took offense to that. And that's when he kind of called him out and, like, you know, when have you actually fought and when have you actually done? And you're really kind of irrelevant and all that. And it really was just a
total... I was really hoping Jamie was just going to be real. Like, you realize you're the white trash of this, of Westeros?
But it's good. It was kind of like a total taking apart of him, because, you know, he was taken apart by his allies and then his enemies show up and take ultimate revenge. And he realizes that his not only is he dying, but, you know, his sons are dead, too. And that's just a beautiful thing. And this is quite an episode for just wiping whole houses off the map, basically.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a ton of houses just completely devastated. The Freys are the first one that we'll talk about in this episode. But yeah, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, like, the theme of like houses all being wiped out. That's definitely, I mean, the kill list in this episode is long. RIP everyone.
Oh yeah.
But we also got the sort of the parallels in Arya saying the last thing you're going to see is a Stark smiling down at you as you die. Which is kind of the same thing that, like, Cersei recalled with Septa, what's her face?
The Hot Nun.
about, yeah, the last thing you're going to see is my face before you die. So again, just Game of Thrones does this a lot. I like seeing
a lot
like
of symmetry.
Out, yeah, I like pointing out the symmetry, but that was definitely one that I wrote down the line because it was like, ha, there's symmetry there. Parallels. I like it.
Yeah, I thought that was definitely a good touch. And I hope that that's something that Arya carries through. Every time she's going for one of these kills, I want her to be that ruthless, awful murderer that that really gets her way and really, you know, makes those killing scenes that much better. But let's move on to our next person to talk about, which someone we finally have seen for the first time in like 5 or 6 episodes, a certain someone trying to be something.
Old Town and Sam.
Yes, for the first time we see Old Town, which reminded me of the Colosseum with that torch burning on the top. How cool was that to see Old Town, Jake?
It reminded me of the Rose Bowl. I don't know why.
It reminded me of neither, but cool.
All right, fair enough, fair enough. Well, we see Sam, Gilly, and Lil Sam come up to Old Town. Then they go into the Citadel, which has a really awkward moment. And we see that librarians, no matter how nerdy they are, they're still kind of dicks in their own little way. Their own little dicky way.
Kind of universal, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so
On the What's Brewing Show, we have a guest every once in a while. His name is Copernos, and he happens to be a L.A. County librarian. And he has a very similar affect to him. And I was wondering if that's what he looks like when he's at work.
I wouldn't be surprised. So we see him go through his little book, and you know, Sam says he was sent down by Jon Snow, the commander at the Wall, and he's like, no, it says Aemon Targaryen is the Grand Maester at the Wall. Nope, he's dead. Yep. Well, are you sure? Yep, I'm dead. I'm sure. Okay. Well, we're gonna look into it. By the way, no women and children, and he says it in the most
no women, no
ways.
Children.
Yeah, like calm down, bro. Calm down. But Sam walks in the library, which looks awesome. I thought it was a great view. It reminded me something out of Harry Potter, just how tall and massive they made that thing look. And it reminded me of something inside of Hogwarts where you would see, like, you know, the stairs moving around and stuff. But how cool was it that we see Sam in this world, but at the same time, they don't really there's nothing for Sam to do in this episode. It is really just 2 minutes of him getting there and finding out that he's made it, and that's it. There's nothing else that you can take from it. Can you, Alicia?
The reason, I think, for this scene existing in this episode is just to set up the Citadel sending the White Raven so that then Sansa and Jon can have their little winter is coming giggle. So it's kind of a weird scene for this episode. It probably could have come earlier in the season, but I think they wanted to have that sort of transition. One thing I wanted to point out, because I don't think there's a lot of time to spend on this particular area, is that the library itself, you know, when he comes through and looks up at like the library silo in the center or whatever. Anyone who's watched Doctor Who, am I crazy for thinking that looks like the silence in the library?
Yeah, no, you brought it up before I could bring it up, but I was thinking exact same thing. Yeah, it was definitely like the place where Riversong ended up dying. Yeah, I agree with everything Alicia said. My favorite part of that scene, however, was after, you know, the librarian goes through the whole rigmarole with Sam of, oh yeah, Master Aemon, he died. Oh, Mormont, oh yeah, he died. They had one real quick shot of him saying, okay, I'll bring you back to the library. But before he did that, he scratched out the names very quickly. And I love that little part. That was great. He was like, okay, moving forward.
Yeah, because you know how particular librarians and maesters and all that stuff, all those people are at the Citadel. So very, very by the book, literally. But let's move on because there's nothing else to talk about, Sam. Obviously, he's going to be a character going forward. And he's going to have to get back into the story, which I think we're going to see him get back into the story pretty quickly into the next season, or at least when the next time we see Jon there at Winterfell, because they're going to want to figure out what's up with Sam, or Sam's going to send a raven, something. I don't know, but let's move on. Speaking of someone close to Jon and talk about Jon, let's move on to that little Stark.
The Wall.
Bran Stark.
We see Bran and Mira and Cold Hands Benjen, and Benjen says farewell. So we only saw him for like 5 minutes of screen time. Is that disappointing, Jake?
I don't think so, because they took so damn long to get him into it. You know, in the books, he came along when Sam was making his journey from north of the wall to south of the wall, and Bran was making his journey from south of the wall to north of the wall. That's when the Benjen figure, Cold Hands, first appeared. And so that was pretty far back in the story. In the TV show, they let it roll a little bit further forward. And now we're kind of heading towards the end of the breakneck pace. So, you know, we'll see if he still has a role to play. I'll bet you he still shows up at some point, because he said he's going to continue the fight. So I'll bet you we have some resolution with him.
All right. Well, we see Bran there and one of the weirwood trees, and he goes up and has to be his three-eyed raven self, and he sees a vision and his Tower of Joy. And Alicia, how long have you been waiting for this damn Tower of Joy scene, and did it live up to your expectations?
I've been waiting a long time for it. I don't think it lived up to my expectations, because I don't think it ever could have lived up to my expectations, because...
what were you expecting?
That's my point, is that, like, all I wanted was for it to be there just to confirm the theory that Jon is the son of Lyanna Stark and Rhaegar Targaryen. Like, that's all I needed. I didn't even need to see it. I just needed someone to confirm, and Bran seeing it is the confirmation. So... I don't know that the scene could have done anything but sort of check that box. It was just like the scene didn't move me in any way, except for the whole, like, yes, it's confirmed.
Was anybody worried that they weren't going to reveal it when she started to whisper? Because I was kind of worried that they were going to
a little bit.
And then finally, then when she says, oh, but Robert, I'll be so pissed when he finds out. So, you know, that whole thing. And I was like, okay, confirmed, bad boy.
My only beef, tell me if I'm wrong about this. I wanted it to be out there completely clear. I wanted it to be completely obvious.
You think it was once they had the shot of the baby
I think it's obvious. I think it's obvious for the three of us who know the story. But I'm saying, if you're a show watcher and you're not one of the people that's Googling for theories and looking up stuff from the books, have you picked up on who Rhaegar is? Did they ever say Rhaegar by name?
They didn't.
Did I miss that part?
If there is any ambiguity left, yeah, I think we can definitely conclude that Jon is Lyanna's daughter, which makes him a Stark for sure, right? We can all agree on that.
Daughter? I thought he was the son.
Son, yeah, I'm sorry. he is a Stark. He's a Stark son, like, legit. He's no, you know, he's no longer. I guess he's still up. He's not a. Does that make him a bastard? He's definitely a Stark, though. But he's a Stark from a different, you know, from not from Ned, but from Lyanna. But you're right. They never did say Rhaegar in particular. But there's no other reason why Robert would be so pissed, I don't think. So, oh, I mean, I think,
well,
we,
yeah,
can safely conclude that.
Absolutely. I agree. I thought it was going to be one of those scenes where, for the book readers, it was going to be the ambiguity plus the head nods and winks where you're like, oh, yes, this is exactly what this is. And then for the show watchers, it was going to be Bran snaps out of it. He looks at Mira and says, oh, my God, I just saw Jon is not my father's. He's Lyanna and Rhaegar Targaryen's son. And I'm really sorry, Mira, but you weren't there, even though I was hoping you were going to be there. Like, that's what I was hoping he was going to say.
This is HBO, though, so they don't have to spell it out to their audience. Also, I think they really spelled it out. Like, there is no other reason to do a face fade between a baby and a man like that.
I know that. I know that part. I'm just saying, I don't think it was abundantly, obviously clear that they were saying Jon is a Targaryen. Like, I know that they said Jon is a Targaryen, but I don't think they said it in big, bright letters. Jon is a Targaryen.
One thing I'm going to argue, though, is that the previously on Game of Thrones bit, like, spelled out the whole story. They had the whole, like, I think it was Bran who was talking about, or was it Sansa, whatever, the previous episode where they're explaining, like, Lyanna was kidnapped and raped by Rhaegar, and by, you know, and they basically spell out the whole thing. So if anyone's paying attention at that,
I'm just concerned.
One thing I'll say about
this show watchers like my mom, who are not like super in depth. Like my mom is saying, so she calls me, you know, on Sunday morning saying that she's watched the last four episodes because she was four episodes behind. Have we seen Riverwalk before? I don't remember them.
Riverwalk.
But that was several seasons ago, and you know, I find myself forgetting that kind of stuff too because just of how long ago it was. But I think it would be fairly clear, if not readily apparent. Like,
I think you should worry about yourself, Michael, and your mom's on her own.
Yeah, and that's why you're there to explain things to your mom. The one thing like about this particular scene, I don't know why. Well, I do know why. The reason that it needs to be in this episode is that so they can do that crossfade between the baby's face to John's face right before the King in the North scene. I feel like this. I don't like they didn't need to cut short the Tower of Joy scene the first time. This was the kind of thing that they could have just confirmed earlier in the season, in my opinion. But it still works.
It felt like it was only a 30-second scene in general anyways.
Yeah, but they needed to bring Bran back for the finale. So they were going to put him in last episode or this episode. They could have played this scene. They could have played Sam's scene last episode or this episode. That's just how they chose to arrange it.
All right, question I have for you before we move on. Did you get enough of Bran this season? Do you think they should have shown more of him? Were you let down? Did he meet your expectations? Alicia?
I think Bran is fine. I think there's only so much he could do in this season. Now that he knows, now that he is the Three-Eyed Raven, they can use him more. But I think there were other things to set up. I don't think he was that necessary.
All right. I see. I disagree with that. But okay, Jake, your thing before I opine in here?
I think they certainly moved his story along quite a bit. I mean, if you look at, they skipped him for a whole season, then they came back and he went from being just a trainee in joining up with the trees and learning from the Three-Eyed Raven to becoming the Three-Eyed Raven. So as far as the plot moving forward, even though we didn't get a whole lot of minutes of seeing him, they really did move the plot forward with him quite a ways. He went from being an apprentice to being kind of the master just over the course of this one season. I am still curious as to how he will play into what else is developing in the story. That's what I want to know, and I assume we'll find that out over the next, two half seasons.
Yeah, see, that to me, I thought the first five episodes of Bran were great. They really walked us along and gave us more and more and more of Bran until we saw the big episode with Hodor's death. But from that point on, we saw Bran twice for about a total of like 5 minutes, and it was kind of disappointing. So I don't know what else to show. But
there was nothing else to show but him on a horse riding through snow.
I get that, but it was just...
We got a Hodor explanation. We got the fact that Jon Snow is Lyanna's son explanation.
Saying that the way his season arc was, it ended too early. That at the end of the season, you're like, well, I wish I would have had more. And it's just because it was so jam packed in those first five episodes. The last five episodes were really brandless almost. But I don't know. Let's move on.
Well, before you move on, I'm just real curious to see how they play his kind of power out over the next two seasons, because so far he's only gone back in time. But the way I understand,
well, he's going to go back and kill baby Hitler.
The power of the trees, of course. Another Doctor Who episode, by the way. Another River Song thing. But I'm curious to see if they're going to develop his power to actually be able to go forward in time too, because that's kind of how they explained the power of the Three-Eyed Raven, is that they kind of see all of time all at once. And if that's the case, then they can really kind of fool around with going forward in time too. Although I don't know if they're going to get into that.
Yeah, there's so many different possibilities with him, being able to go back into time just with visions and potentially affect time, all that kind of stuff really leaves his storyline pretty open-ended. But let's move back over to John. Over at a certain place.
Winterfell. Jon Snow.
Sansa Stark.
Davos. Littlefinger. And I should add in Melisandre as well.
That's going to be a record for the Tormund most number of jobs.
Well, isn't Tormund to get a drop? I'm really upset.
Do we see Tormund?
Yeah, and Lyanna Mormont doesn't get a drop. She hasn't earned a drop yet.
I know, and I have to put in the whatever the Waverlys or whoever those were too, and all those all those guys.
Yeah, first of all,
the Glovers.
Standing ovation for Lyanna Mormont.
She's my favorite.
What a badass! What an absolute badass!
She is like easily my favorite character on the show right now, like of all of them. She's just a joy.
There was a great tweet from Dave Lozo on Twitter. Go listen to his podcast, the Puck Soup podcast with Greg Wyshynski. But he on Twitter put, he says, in 9 months, and it's like a news anchor. A new study shows that 6 million babies were born in April with the name Lyanna, which I thought
nice.
Was probably accurate. I mean, if you're having a kid right now and she's born 9 months from now, I'm definitely thinking Lyanna is a possibility there. But let's start this at the very beginning of this whole little interesting realm that we see with in Winterfell. Is that Davos comes up to confront Melisandre and asks that she's executed, and Jon gives her a stay and says that she just needs to go away forever and banishes her from the north and tells her to go southward. Your thoughts about that, Jake?
Yeah, I'm real curious to see how that's going to work out, because she has been a very potent force, obviously, but of course it got a little sideways with her and Stannis, and I think that you could tell by the way that she was answering Jon's questions and the way that she responded to Davos that she felt guilty about killing Shireen. But at the end of the day, this goes back to what I was saying last week, in that she is not lost faith in her religion. She did for a minute, but now she is full force behind the faith and religion. She just doesn't know what her part to play is anymore. And I'm real curious to see if this somehow affects Winterfell and House Stark in a negative way with her gone, or if they end up being better for it. But I'm sure we haven't seen the last of her, and where she turns up, obviously, Tyrion and Dany had the Red Priestesses kind of talking about them. I'm curious to see where she ends up, and will she kind of hook up with Dany when Dany hits the mainland? I don't know, but we'll have to see.
Yeah, it's gonna be something to watch going forward. I think it's interesting. Davos definitely wanted her executed. Jon was kind of torn there, because I mean, Melisandre just brought him back from the dead. But at the same time, Jon is a man of honor, and he's very much like Ned, and wants to carry out the honor and duty of the law, and that would be killing and executing Melisandre. But he knows that, hey, he wouldn't be there if it wasn't for her.
Yeah, but you know what? I also wonder if Jon was kind of conveniently using this as an excuse to banish her. Like, he wasn't ever going to have her executed, but he was, remember last episode, he was very uncomfortable with the fact that he has been resurrected, and he outright told her not to resurrect him again. So I wonder if this kind of plays into what he wants a little bit, and that now he had an excuse to get rid of her. So that he knows that she can't kind of work her magic on him again. I had a feeling that was part of John's motivations as well.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Well, let's go talking about the other red woman, the red-haired woman, the authentically red-haired woman, Sansa. She, meets up with Baelish. Baelish kind of, spills the beans. He wants to sit on the Red Throne. He wants to sit on the Iron Throne, and he wants Sansa's hand right in marriage and everything, and she gets the courage to reject him, because we know that Baelish definitely wanted her mom, Catelyn Stark. That didn't work out, so he's going for Sansa. Doesn't work out. She rejects him, and so now there's this awkward thing of Baelish is just kind of hanging out there in Winterfell. And how weird is that, Alicia?
Weird or just straight up creepy? Baelish is a character that I don't trust. I could never trust. I'm glad that Sansa appears not to trust him, but I also worry, because Sansa is the kind of character who has the tendency to be annoying. And I think the future of her annoyance is going to be either being manipulated by or buying into whatever Baelish is selling. And like her influence on his influence on her is one that makes me really uncomfortable for like the future. Especially with, you know, I mean, we're going to talk about the King in the North scene, but the end of that scene is Sansa and Baelish sharing a look. And I don't know how to read that look quite yet. I have an interpretation that makes me not happy. And I have another interpretation that I can sort of put as the like, I would rather it be Sansa like looking at him disapprovingly, because that's what she gave him in this scene that we're talking about. He's definitely setting up he is trying to sever the, you know, sibling relationship that Sansa and Jon have. And I think he's good enough at this game that he could pull it off. So my question coming out of this scene was, I mean, for you guys, I don't know if either of you know, like Baelish is always talking about having the true Stark and that she has the Stark name and she is the true Stark and all that kind of stuff. Who has the power to make Jon a Stark?
Nobody.
Like, does anybody, if the head of the household, like, could Bran theoretically
Jon a Stark? I guess you could say everyone declaring that he is the King of the North. I guess
Lyanna Mormont had that power, is what I was going to say.
Right, by making him King of the North, officially? It doesn't matter that he's not officially a Stark, right?
But like his name is still Jon Snow. So like, what would it take for him to be Jon Stark?
I think that it would have to, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think
now
that
he's King,
Stannis was going to call him Jon Stark. You know, he offered him that. It would take the king, the recognized king, recognizing him as a Stark. That's all it would take. You know, that's what happened with Ramsay. Or you know what? Actually,
Maybe that's how the series ends. Daenerys gets the throne, and she's like, "Okay, I will now officially make you Jon Targaryen," and he's like, "No, make me Jon Stark."
Yeah, I don't even think of it need that though, because look, I mean, Ramsay Bolton was legitimized by his dad, wasn't he? I mean, I don't remember if they had to go to Joffrey to have that recognized or not, but I think
it was just his dad.
Roos just said, "Hey, I acknowledge you as my son." Bam, there you go. So I think that Sansa, as the supposedly the last remaining Stark, recognizing her brother as a Stark, I think that might be good enough. But I mean, you know, who knows? It's all, you know, the North recognizes Jon as the King of the North, so there you go. And that will work until they get defeated by some other army, you know, whether it's the people in the South or whether it's Dany or whatever. It all has to do with whoever's in power at that moment can recognize whatever they want. That's why, you know, and this was in this television series a bit, but in the books, it was almost like a running joke of, well, who has the rights to Harrenhal? It was Littlefinger, and it was the guy that chopped off Jaime's arm, and it was another guy. You know, there was like four people. I think Janos Slynt was in charge of Harrenhal at some point too. You know, there were like five different people that had a claim to being in charge of Harrenhal, and it was just from, well, whose perspective are we talking about? Which king granted them the right to Harrenhal? So it's all in the who's in charge right now. That's who can name Jon as a Stark or not.
You know, Jake, my question for you about Baelish, this is clearly the weakest we've seen Baelish. He looks like he's finally been beaten in his own game. You know, Alicia says that she's worried about what it's going to become of him and Sansa going forward, and that, you know, you can never trust Baelish. Do you think Sansa's finally turned the corner in the sense that she is always going to have the upper hand going forward? Baelish is His hand has been shown. The cards have been dealt, and it now looks like he has he doesn't have the upper hand anymore. I don't know where he goes from here. Am I weird for thinking that?
I don't think you're weird at all for thinking that. I think that Baelish will still have a part to play in this, and it seems like to me, like we were talking about earlier about how the next season's gonna play out, and certainly it seems like Dany and Cersei and Dorne and Lady Olenna are going to be occupying each other in Euron and the Greyjoys and all that. They're going to be occupying each other down south. And then we were wondering, well, what the hell are they going to be doing in Winterfell? And I think they'll be preparing to battle the White Walkers coming down. But I think before they do that, there probably will be some dissension sown by Littlefinger and his troops, and that will probably be the source of the conflict for the Starks in the near future. And I don't know. I'm curious to see, like you're speculating, will Sansa always have the upper hand now with Littlefinger? I don't know. I don't think you can underestimate. I'm sure he'll have one last kind of salvo.
Well, the interesting thing for me though is that you look at Varys and you look at Littlefinger, and they've always seemed like equal opposites. They were the schemers that were, you know, working behind the scenes, and those were the guys that were really playing the game from a matter of not having traditional power. Right now, Varys, if anyone's winning the game right now, it's Varys. And yeah, Littlefinger is at the lowest he's been.
We talked about that before. I don't think Varys' goal is to become, you know, is to rule the Iron Throne.
I don't think Varys is playing the game to actually hold the throne himself, but he's in the most sound position right now. Would you agree? Of anyone in the game, he has the it's least likely that he is going to be killed in the next episode. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but just gave him the kiss of death, though.
What I said before, you know, we said this, we talked about this last episode or the one before, is that, you know, Varys is not in this, it doesn't seem like to me, for selfish reasons. He really is a character that is motivated by bringing Westeros together and finding the best path to, you know, having a unified, peaceful kingdom. Like, he's kind of got, for lack of a better term, the greater good in mind. I think that's what Varys' ultimate goal is. And as was spelled out in this episode, Baelish's prime motivation is himself, him being the ruler, him getting the Iron Throne, him getting Sansa. And I think that's really the difference in the two characters. When you say that the Baelish and Littlefinger, Baelish and Varys are, two similar characters, I would say it's more of like kind of like a triangle. And we have Tyrion and Baelish and Varys, and Littlefinger is a little bit of Tyrion and a little bit of Varys, you know, as far as, you know, non-traditional power, I guess. But I think all three of them have to be kind of linked together in how they play out. But I think Varys and Tyrion are really trying to be of good, and Littlefinger is just more of a selfish type of, like a mercenary type.
I also think you're writing off, I think you're too quick to act like Varys, like Littlefinger is in a bad position right now. He's not in the position that he would like, but like he says in this episode, everything he thinks about is, how do I make this dream of mine happen? So yeah, when he's closing his eyes right now and thinking of that image that he wants of the Iron Throne, he still has his ability to scheme and plan. He still has his fingers in at least some sort of connection to Sansa. He is still aligned with the King in the North. As you know, squicky and weird as he is, he still has that allegiance, that alliance right now. He is in a position to influence things. So he still is set up in such a way that it's not like he's, you know, destitute in terms of the strings he can pull.
And I think it's important.
And remember, he has the string. He's holding the strings to the Aaron kid.
Well, he could also, you know, he has a connection with the Lannisters. He could now go to Cersei once he figures out that Cersei is the queen, and maybe he plays that card.
He's in position to really, you know, really screw things up, however he does it. But I think that instead of saying that he is, you know, defeated or there's not really any place for him to go, this is just a matter of, he set out his two goals. Goal one was to sit the Iron Throne. Goal 1A was to sit the Iron Throne with Sansa. Well, now he realizes that the Sansa thing might not be in the cards, so he'll probably just pivot and put all of his force and energy into, making moves to get himself to the Iron Throne. Now, whether or not he's successful, that's another thing. But I'll bet you that he still is potent enough to really, you know, cause a lot of conflict for whoever, you know, the Starks, for Dany, for whoever, going into season, the following season.
All right, well, let's move along and go to the capital.
King's Landing.
Cersei Lannister.
Yes, All Cersei. It starts out and great little montage scene at the beginning with everyone getting ready for Loras's his trial. Alisa, you made some notes in our little show notes here that we have, our little rundown sheet, about the music. And how did that speak to you?
It was totally different. It set the episode off in a totally different way tonally. I'd have to go back and check back on past episodes to see if this was the case. But even the previously on had these weird dissonant piano notes in it that just sounded weird to me for the show. And then it begins with this, basically it's an extended montage over this piano piece that has some of the Game of Thrones themes in it, but it's really just the piano dominant. And I cannot remember a single moment in the show's history where piano has been used at all, let alone a featured instrument. The show has really relied on strings and percussion and like horns and that kind of thing. So it just felt totally different and totally weird. And I mean, like in a good way, it really set this opening sequence apart. It had me on edge, actually, because I was sort of sitting there going like, this is weird. This is strange. There's something off to this. And I almost felt like, you know, Marjorie sitting there in the place looking around going like, there is something wrong. And it kind of played off really well the way that the whole thing played out in the end with, the big kaboom.
When this was unfolding, did you think that they were going to kill all the Tyrells and the High Sparrow all in one fell swoop? I mean, at what point did that register with you? Because to me, I didn't think they were going to get them all until they started evacuating and the Faith Militant were keeping people from leaving. That's when I was like, holy shit, they're going to blow all these people.
Hold on. Marjorie
was
going
to be Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Let's slow this down because we need to talk about the Lancel Lannister thing. And Lancel being shanked in the catacombs and that awesome scene of him realizing, holy crap, there's a bunch of TNT down here, aka wildfire, and him trying to figure out a way to stop it and blow out those candles. Like, wasn't that an awesome scene? Because I loved that the duality of him trying to get to the candle and blow it out, and then everyone inside the Sept trying to get out. When you see that Marjorie finally, you know, comes to her senses and she realizes, hey, Cersei's not here because she probably has a damn good reason not to be here, so we need to get out of here. She's trying to convince everybody. You see Mace Tyrell trying to get out. They were not letting him out. And then you go back to Lancel and he's just trying to crawl on his belly to get to the candle, and you see the High Sparrow. He's conflicted. I thought that scene was awesome. I thought the tension was awesome because I don't know about you guys, but it reminded me of the scene when Ned Stark was executed. Because
it didn't remind me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Because you can see the pending doom, and you're like, no, that's not going to happen. Like, something's going to like Lancel at the very end is going to blow out the candle and divert it. Like, it's too obvious that this impending doom is going to happen. It's not going to happen. Like, no, they're not going to kill Ned Stark because it's too obvious. And then they have that pause and it goes silent for about 3 seconds. And you're like, oh, so maybe they didn't do it. Maybe they. Oh, shoot. There it went.
Yeah, to me, it was a very Godfather-y scene. Just, you know, and part of that was the fact that, you know, Cersei's sitting there, you know, preparing to drink her wine, and then, you know, the zombie mountain comes in and stops Tommen from going, and all that stuff happens. And it was all just cutting back and forth and back and forth, and the music that Alicia was pointing out, it was all something that was very unique in this Game of Thrones series. It's the first time we really had a long scene like that, I think. I can't remember any other ones. Going forward, you know, we talked about how the plot is kind of resolving itself at a breakneck pace, and this was really a way that the showrunners were able to completely wipe out a huge point of conflict in the story. Marjorie bought it. You know, and at the end of the day, Tommen buys it. At the end of the day, all the Tyrells buy it. The High Sparrow buys it. You know, and it's really kind of a nice way to kind of put a bow on this whole thing and wrap it all up for Cersei. She gets her revenge, gets rid of all of her enemies, and and it was quite a feat. You guys were right about the whole wildfire. I know you guys had heard that theory somewhere else. But it was quite an explosion. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's quite the way to get rid of the entire Faith storyline that I hated.
Oh yeah,
like the entire problem, that whole problem, the whole like occupation of the city by these militant like Faith people, like just in a snap, just gone. And in that sense, it was kind of genius. I loved the way the sequence played out. Especially the cuts back and forth between Lancel sort of catching on to the little boy and Maester Pycelle getting drawn in to the basement or wherever.
Hey, that was blood that was uncalled for. Oh my God, that was nasty.
But what I loved about it was that they're setting up that there is a, like, by that point, you know, there is a plot. It's just a question of what is the plot and who is the target, like how, like, basically, how broad is the scope of this plot? And, you know, once Lancel sees the wildfire, you realize, like, holy crap, it's that big. But, there's a moment in there where it's like, is she just setting this up to, you know, to get the army back in? Is there something else going on? So, like, just the when you mentioned, like, the tension building in that sequence was just... It was perfection. It was perfect. The only thing I didn't like, and this is just totally personal, is that I'm just really bummed that Marjorie was part of the fallout there. I kind of had they sparked a little bloom of hope, because by that point, you know, I just sort of realized, like, oh crap, everyone's gonna blow up. The spark of hope that, like, Marjorie gets it, she's gonna leave herself, and that's gonna be the way that they save that character for later, because I think she's an interesting character in the game. But alas.
At the end of the day, the High Septon turned out to be exactly who he said he was. He was just kind of a pious guy. And right to the end of it, he kind of got outplayed by Cersei. But it really doesn't seem like he was anything but what he said he was. And I thought that was kind of interesting, too. But it kind of led to all of their demise.
You know, you're talking about the houses that, you know, have been damaged, like the Freys are now all gone.
Freys, you know, gone. Tyrell's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. Baratheons are all gone. The Lannisters are now down just to Cersei and Jaime for the most part. Kevin's gone. Tyrion has been ostracized. But we see
really,
Cersei.
Really, Dorne is gone too, isn't it? I mean, all you have is a bunch of daughters left, and, you know, and they're not really, they were all, you know.
Who else is gone? Bastards. Who was that you said?
The Dornes are, the Dorne, what am I saying? The
Yeah, but the difference is Martells. That in Dorne, women and bastards are given power.
Yeah, I guess.
Right, and they're allowed, they're not seen as a negative. So that, I mean, yeah, that's another house that is damaged, but I think that They're still in the game. We're going to talk about them in a couple minutes, but let's talk about Cersei taking the throne, and Jaime coming back to look at her and how uncomfortable that look was, because
and the whole Tommen throwing himself out the window.
The whole that might be a little bit important. We might need to talk about that. So Tommen kills himself, knowing that Marjorie is gone and that High Sparrow is gone after he's kind of bought into the High Sparrow.
Were you guys shocked by that? When he threw himself out the window, were you like,
yes,
oh my gosh,
yes,
did that just happen?
Yes and no. No, because I expected Tommen to die in this episode. When all those people were dying, there was no way Tommen was not going to die too. But I didn't expect him to die like that. At least once the mountain protected him from leaving, I'm like, okay, so maybe he's not going to die. But there was going to be more shakeup to it, so it made sense that he did die. That he died that way was still shocking.
I caught on as soon as they lingered on the window, just from a you know, filming perspective, lingering on the window after he leaves the frame. It's like, oh crap, he's going to come back and he's going to fling himself off the window. But I think Tommen's death might be one of the most fitting deaths in the entire series, because Cersei has, you know, everything is about her children, right? We've had this conversation before. Joffrey gets assassinated. Marcella gets assassinated. And so Cersei gets to blame people for those things. Cersei gets to blame Tyrion or, you know, whoever, and the plotters for Joffrey. She gets to blame Dorne for Marcella. But Tommen is driven to suicide by Cersei. And, you know, her kids, Joffrey was really messed up. Marcella and Tommen had the chance to be normal, but the circumstances sort of screwed them over too. And Tommen was never fit to be king, not at that age, not with all this scheming going around, not with the way that he was being manipulated by everyone around him. It was a natural, in a weird way, it was just the most fitting death for somebody like Tommen, who was not in control of his life and sort of ends it in a weird, just sad kind of way, in control. But it comes down to Cersei bringing that fate upon her son because of her own messed up ambition. And I don't think that she set this all up with, you know, her own ambitions in mind, except for the idea of saving herself, and in whatever way she thought of it as saving her son. She just miscalculated majorly. And the showrunners talked about it in the inside the episode bit at the end, about how Cersei did this and then left him alone.
Yeah.
And the outcome is kind of, it follows after that. When you're busy, torturing or getting your comeuppance for Septa Una hot or nun. Whatever.
Unilla.
Yeah, hot nun. Unilla, instead of dealing with the fallout of what you just did to your son, then that's kind of, you reap what you sow, don't you?
No, I think absolutely. And I think going forward, Cersei, she has always justified what she did as, I'm going to do everything for my children, no matter how vile or disgusting it is. And at the end of the day, that gets shown to be bankrupt. And what she gets with her actions of trying only to protect her family, despite, no matter what type of horrible thing she does to protect her family, what she buys is a family that doesn't want her. Now she has a son who commits suicide. And like you said, that's totally on her. And those looks we get from Jaime at the end when she's being installed as queen are they disdain? Are they disgust? Are they, I don't want to be here anymore? Are they, oh, gee whiz, I wish I had a 6-foot, Brienne standing next to me instead of Cersei now? So her, Machiavellian, the ends justify the means, have kind of flown back in her face. And now she is a character that really has nothing to lose and nothing to fight for other than her own just kind of bitter, revenge and personal ambition. And so I don't think it's going to be very far.
And it's going to be very interesting. We've had the Jaime conversation about which side is he falling on.
Right.
Remember that Jaime became the Kingslayer because of Wildfyre. And for Cersei to turn around and use that as a weapon to destroy a chunk of the city, I think is very interesting. And somebody pointed out on Twitter that Cersei is pretty much the Mad Queen at this point.
I don't know about that.
Let's talk about the prophecy, because we see at the beginning of season 4 or season 5 when it opens up with her being told a prophecy from a witch. The three things she's told, you'll never wed the prince, you'll wed the king. That turned out to be true. She married Robert Baratheon. She didn't marry, Rhaegar Targaryen. She didn't go for the prince. She ended up marrying the king. Number two, you'll be queen for a time. Then comes a younger, another younger, more beautiful queen to cast you down and take you for all you hold dear. That was Margaery. And number three, the king will have 20 children and you will have 3. Gold will be their crowns. Gold will be their shrouds. Well, all three of her children have been killed. We've seen Joffrey and Marcella were both poisoned, and now we see Tommen commit suicide. So the first three parts of the prophecy have come true. The fourth part was that her little brother will be the one who kills her. So now that's what we wait for. Like, is that Jaime? Is that Tyrion?
Who is the Kingslayer?
Right. Yeah.
Who is the one who killed the Mad King to prevent him from using wildfire? I think if we didn't already have a lot of proof to suggest that Jaime is going to be the one that puts Cersei out of her misery, it's absolutely clear that that's where this is heading.
If was there a more uncomfortable line in the entire series than her saying she F's Jaime because it feels good to have her brother inside her? Oh my God, was that uncomfortable?
I don't know. We've been dealing with this for the whole series. So I loved that. As soon as she started talking, I was like, oh, she's going to confess. That's pretty fun. You know, she said about how. And then the very last line was, you know, even confessing feels good. I really liked that scene. And you knew that she was going to lay it on very thick to the hot nun. So, I mean, I was expecting that pretty wholehearted. I knew that was coming.
But before we move on, though, really quick thing. Alicia and I were having a discussion about it. So, Jake, you can kind of settle this. What do you think
Michael's
was going
wrong.
On?
Oh, wait.
Okay. What do you think was going on with the mountain when he came in to see Septuunella?
What do you think? Lewd to discuss. He was raping her, basically.
Okay.
With
thank
a zombie
you. That's,
member.
Yes, that's what I thought. Because we know that he was like the most heinous rapist in all of Westeros.
He is so terrible thing.
Yeah, I thought that it was pretty clear that he was going to be raping her, and apparently that's
rapey.
So some people have seen it differently, but anyways, let's move on and talk about the Dragon Queen
Marine.
Daenerys Stormborn.
Tyrion Lannister.
Yes, and we can throw Varys in there. Lady Olenna, everyone's all joining up together, one giant force.
Dorne. There you go, Dorne,
yes,
too.
Yes, they're all together. They're all together. It was so fun. First of all, let's start in Dorne really quick. That scene with Olenna and the Sand Snakes, how freaking awesome was it for Olenna to tell off the Sand Snakes? Wasn't that great?
Olenna is the greatest. Her telling the one that you look like an angry little boy Olenna is like Bronn, like just brightens up every scene she's in.
She really does.
I'm curious to see whether they're going to, you know, really play that up over the next half season or so and then have her have some sort of kind of weird death, or if she's going to be one of the characters that kind of makes it through the end, even though she's like a totally old crone. I'm not sure which way they're going to go.
I don't know. As long as she's still in it, the better. That's definitely the best thing for now. We see Varys in Dorne, so that's obviously what his mission was to get the Dornish House Martell on their side.
Were you guys surprised by seeing Varys show up?
I was, but then when I saw him, I'm like, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is a good time to talk about it, I think. But, you know, once again, we are being hit with just a huge time lapse in these last couple of seasons with the fact that Varys can go all the way to Dorne and then all the way back to Dragon's Bay, for the last shot of this episode. But we have all the stuff that happens in Winterfell, and we have Sam ending up at Old Town, and we have the stuff that happens with King's Landing. These people are moving across Westeros and across the globe pretty much in huge chunks. So it's really weird how they play around with that in the TV show, because it's much more
time is so vague. So
it's
big.
Compressed, and then it's sped up, and then slowed down. It's crazy.
Yeah, so a lot of people complaining on Twitter because in the final scene of the show, you see Varys on the ship with Daenerys. But I don't think that it was a sign that he was teleporting, because we also see Jaime.
Well, he's not teleporting. It's just
we also see
time.
Right, and we also see, and not literally teleporting, but just that it seems uncomfortable how quickly he's moving compared to everyone else. But we also see Jaime go from the Riverlands all the way back to King's Landing. So that's not much different. Not much different at all.
And obviously the scene with the phrase, you know, takes place we have two scenes with the phrase that take place kind of within the same time period, but during that time, they skip all the way ahead to Jaime making all the way back to King's Landing. So it is a little disconcerting when they have so many different pieces and they have to cover all this territory. It is a little weird seeing it in a show like that.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Also, in that same storyline, we see in Marine, Dario and Daenerys have a big breakup, and Dario doesn't really take it too well. It doesn't take it too well, Alicia. What did you think of Dario getting bite in the dust?
What I think of Dario biting the dust is that maybe he will be back on Orphan Black next season.
Do you think that this is the last we'll see of Dario in this show?
I don't know. Part of me thinks that it might be, because I think the actor is sort of not in high demand, but I think he's getting work. I don't know. I think he as a character had sort of run his course. I don't think Dany needed him. And I think, you know, the logic behind her sort of saying stay put here is good logic, because I don't know what they were going to do with that character to begin with once they got to Westeros. So it kind of wraps it up nice and neatly. But the thing I took away from it was just from an actor perspective, like just like with Loras Tyrell, I knew he was going to have to die at some point because he got cast as Iron Fist in the new Netflix series. Although I don't know, filming schedules, maybe he would have had time to continue, but that's an aside. Either way, I think the way that they sort of spun this whole thing was cool, with Dany worrying a little bit about her. I don't know if it was like compassion or emotional state or whatever it is that, like, I think she worries that she might be becoming heartless. And I like that she's worrying about that. So the scene with Dario was, you know, good enough. But the scene that came after with Dany and Tyrion was really the thing that I took away from that whole bit.
No, I think so, too. And I kind of feel like, just like they very quickly wrapped up the conflict in Slaver's Bay, I think that Dany telling him that he's staying behind and giving a very, you know, well-explained reason as to why he's staying behind, and then saying, oh, yeah, you're here to make sure the transition is fine and make sure that all these different cities find their local governments. And then we're renaming it Dragon's Bay, because there's no question at all that, you know, that I have completely conquered this area and we're going to keep it like that, keep and continue the same thing. To me, it felt like that was his resolution, and now he's kind of taken off the board. And I don't think we're going to go back to Marine for the rest of the series. Obviously, that I could be wrong, but that's kind of how it felt.
Yeah, I think we're definitely done with Marine, just like we have been done with all those other cities that they've been to. You know, like season two when Daenerys was going through Essos to different places. Yeah, I think we're definitely done with Essos in general. I don't think we might never see Essos again, actually. Like, when are we gonna see Braavos again? When are we gonna see Pentos?
I don't think there's any reason to.
Yeah, there's definitely not. Everything from now on is all about Westeros. And so Dany sails to Westeros. We see, you know, Varys back on her ship. We see some flags from the sails from the Martells and from the Tyrells. Everyone is all aboard. So we have the Targaryens, the subsect of Greyjoys led by Yara and Theon, and we have the Martells and the Tyrells all united behind Daenerys as their hopeful heir to the throne. And then
fire
in the north
and blood.
Yeah, and then in the north you have Jon Snow, who is king in the north, and then you have Cersei Lannister sitting on the throne in King's Landing, and then north of the wall you have all those White Walker blue dudes who are the other unknown.
I know we didn't talk about it, but Cersei looked pretty hot in that outfit she had. I thought that was a pretty striking, you know, like that black queen armory outfit. I thought that was pretty kick-ass. Even though I don't like Cersei, I like
it. She looks so different now than she did before. Like, first of all, that those shoulder pad things definitely made her look different, and she just looks so different with the short hair still. I'm not used to it.
I totally agree with Jake that like the what she was wearing was pretty badass, but her hair has gotten to Julie Andrews length, and it just was taking me out of it. Like, it was just like I just look at her and I see Julie Andrews, and there that I mean that is the biggest, like, just does not compute for me between Cersei Lannister and Julie Andrews.
That's funny. And this episode there were so many scenes of her like getting dressed and getting ready and pouring her wine and clipping the little things in place that, you know, they definitely were, focusing on her taking control, certainly of King's Landing. And I think she thought she was going to take control and, you know, kind of be the pub master for Tommen. And it turned out that, no, she's no longer the pub master. Now she's actually the queen. That's the first thing I wrote in my notes when Tommen bought it was, well, who the hell's in charge now? You know, and you heard it, Cersei, first of her name, Queen of the Andals, blah, 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 leader of the Seven Kingdoms. I'm wondering how short-lived that will be.
Yeah, a short-lived reign of terror.
Long may she reign, but yeah, maybe
that,
not
like
that
the weakest long. Long may she reign ever? Like, there was like,
yeah,
long may she reign.
Yeah.
Long may she reign. That was kind of a tell.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't much there. Let's really quick, hopes for next season. What are you hoping to see? What one conflict or one storyline that you're hoping really gets played up next season, Jake?
I'm hoping that there is a nice resolution between Cersei and Tyrion, and I'm hoping that's Tyrion, you know, really putting it down on Cersei at some point or another. The one thing we forgot to mention, or that I forgot to bring up, was the fact that, you know, Dany installs Tyrion as her hand, and that was a really kind of a cool, touching scene. But then you notice that Cersei, her hand is, and that's Qyburn and all of his little weird Children of the Corn kids running around stabbing people. So I think that is just a natural conflict that will hopefully be in our future season. I want to see, however Cersei's storyline gets resolved, I hope Tyrion is a part of it. And I really can't see how it is not. How her and really, I guess, just those siblings work it out, because Jaime's going to have a piece of that, and Tyrion's going to have a piece of that. And I'm hoping, obviously, at the end of the day, that Tyrion is victorious.
Next season, I hope they don't draw out too long the wait that we have for some more Stark reunions, because Bran, the knowledge that he has would be very useful to a certain king in the North. And then we know that Arya's back in Westeros. We know that she's going to be running around trying to finish off her kill list. So yeah. I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for the Starks, the Stark children, to sort of have reunions. And I really want to see Arya back in the fold and Bran back in the fold, because I think it's just going to be really interesting. More than anything, though, I kind of like the reason that I really liked this wildfire storyline, even though they had sort of been like blazing it in neon, like flashing lights for pretty much the whole season that wildfire was going to come into play, is that in this episode, it caught me off guard. Like, I wasn't expecting it to play out the way it did. Looking forward at sort of the end game that's happening right now, I feel like I know exactly what's going to happen. And I would like the show to throw me a few loops. Like, I would like the show to leave me feeling like I don't know what's going to happen next. Because I worry that next season might fall into some of those patterns.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting what they do with Euron Greyjoy. Because if Dany just comes in, wipes out Euron Greyjoy's fleet, and then, you know, takes the Lannisters, and the next season ends with her on the throne, and the season after that is just about her and Jon uniting to you know, go on this big adventure against the White Walkers, it almost seems lackluster. Like, it almost seems too perfect, too easy, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think you're putting a little too much stock into Euron. My sense of the Greyjoys throughout, you know, how they've worked, you know, gone in the series and how they've gone in the books and now in the TV show, is that the Greyjoys are really super impressed with the Greyjoys, but really in reality, they're a bunch of weirdo sailor pirate guys that inhabit a couple islands in the north, you know, in the north west seas. And at the end of the day, they really are largely you know, irrelevant. They get beat down by Robert and the Starks, and I have a feeling that they're going to get beat down again. I think the major conflict will come, you know, between Cersei and Dany and the Starks, and then of course the White Walkers. But I wouldn't expect too much out of Euron Greyjoy. I have a feeling that the Greyjoys are always kind of set up for a, if they don't kind of cooperate with the powers that be, if they're, you know, they're trying to kind of revolt like Euron is, I think they're always kind of destined to just get their asses handed to them. So sorry, Michael, that's just how I see it.
All right, fair enough. Yeah, that wraps up the season. That's it. That's all she wrote for Game of Thrones season 6. So my question for you guys is,
wow,
are we done with Rodan gone, or are we going to do a season wrap up, or I don't know. Like, what do you guys want to do?
I am available however you guys need me to be available. I don't know what we're going to talk about, you know, from this point forward until the next season.
How about this? How about we let the people decide? If you want us to do a season recap, or if you have questions for us that you want us to do a season recap with your listener questions, shoot us your tweets at Reign of Troy. Give us your calls on the Reign of Troy line 213-373-1872. Or your emails at reignoftroy@fanside.com. Let us know what you guys want, and we'll put that all together. But yeah, it was super fun to do this. Thanks, Jake, for coming on. You know, Alicia, thanks for going along with my dumb idea. So yeah, this was super fun, and glad to be a part of.
It was my pleasure. I had a blast, and you know, I hope that we keep doing this. It was a lot of fun.
I mean, the reason that I agreed to do this was because the thought of letting Rot on Got go to waste as a title just killed me, and it was much more fun than I thought it would be. I like talking TV with people, so this has been perfect.
For the night is dark and full of terrors.
Indeed.
Yes, it was super, super duper 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 fun. So. You know, we've been talking on, Alicia and I have been talking, you know, behind the curtain about, Reign of Troy that, you know, once you get into July, the season is basically begun. Rodan gone will be over with. Football season basically begins at the beginning of July, because that's when you can start all your preview stuff. Media Day is only 2 weeks away. It's only 2 weeks away. So.
Insane.
I know. So, Jake, tell us what everyone has in store, or what you have in store for What's Brewing Show this season.
Yeah, we have two more episodes coming up in the next month or so. You know, we're approaching our 100th episode, and we're going to do hopefully a season preview about the Bruins. Not that a lot of Reign of Troy fans are going to be too into that, but we're looking forward to a wonderful year of college football. And I, as we'll get, when we get to What's Racha, What Got You, I have a target in my sights for an interview because of a new obsession I have. So we'll get into that in a minute.
All right. Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, let's get to some What's Racha and What's Got You.
What's Racha? What's Got You? What's Racha?
All right, Jake, take it away. You mentioned it, so why don't you get us started?
Yeah, no, I have a new obsession, and that is a podcast I just discovered kind of on accident. Michael, did you listen to the, I think it was like maybe two episodes ago, of the Solid Verbal, and they had a lineman on named Jeff Schwartz. Do you remember that episode? Did you hear that one?
I did not listen to that episode.
they've been the Solid Verbals is a great podcast, and they've been doing a lot of kind of chalk talk type of episodes. And one of them featured a guy named Jeff Schwartz, who was up until recently a lineman, an offensive lineman for the New York Giants. And I realized that he has a podcast that he started last season, about midway through, right in the NFL playoffs. And he's about 35 episodes deep, but it's a podcast from the perspective of an offensive lineman, and they spend, you know, one episode after the other just talking about different technical aspects of being an offensive lineman, and I'm absolutely in love with it. And I've decided that I'm going to have to get this guy on for an interview, because he, if you don't know, obviously you don't, because he's kind of an anonymous NFL offensive lineman, but he went to University of Oregon. He played there. To put him in perspective, his last year was the year of I think the last year of Chip Kelly being the offensive coordinator before he'd be promoted as coach. And he grew up a UCLA fan, and so there's a lot of different things I want to talk to him about. But that is my goal before the season starts, to try to get this guy on an interview. And if you want to know anything about being an offensive lineman, listen to Jeff Schwartz's podcast. I think it's called Block 'Em Up, and it's been very enjoyable for me. That's what's got me, I guess. What's brought me is my computer and not having internet and having to do this podcast on my Verizon wireless minutes. I don't like that.
Bummer, man. Bummer. Bummer, bummer. Alicia, how about you?
Let's see. What's got me is that one of my favorite podcasts, Invisibilia, which is an NPR podcast, they just started their season back up. The nerdiest thing you've ever said. Oh, I will nerd. Ask anyone in my family. I geek out over this podcast every freaking week. Every week, it's just something that blows my mind. It's amazing. It's the best podcast that I listen to. So this is my official recommendation for the Invisibilia podcast. I've been catching up on that. There's been a ton of soccer. It's been amazing. What's rot me right now, though?
Did anyone see what fucking Reading did today against Arsenal?
You know what's rotting
Sounds
me?
Sounds rumpy pumpy!
All the frickin' transfer drama and whining that goes on in the summer when it comes to soccer, it's worse than recruiting, and recruiting is awful. So that's about as good of a thing to rot me as any.
Michael, what's rot you? What's got you?
All right, well, what's rot me? Get straight to it.
How those Cubs doing, Michael? Did you curse them?
I lost 6 of 7 games since I went to Chicago.
That's so funny.
They lost four in a row.
Hold on. How are the Cubbies doing?
I don't want to talk about this anymore. Really don't.
How do you feel that you cursed your team? Like, now they're, you know, I remember the last podcast you were talking about how it's like the first time in their history they were, you know, X number of games over the Cardinals.
We're done.
Where are they now?
We're done now. There's still 9 games up. There's still 9 games up.
Poor
so.
Michael. Poor Cubbies.
Anyways.
Hey, Michael, I have a question for you.
Is Taylor Swift a jinx for the LA Kings? The story at 11.
I hate you so freaking much. I really. On top of this, Milan Lucic isn't coming back to the Kings. Like,
I heard she's dating a Cub. Is there any truth to that rumor?
I'm done, guys. There's nothing that's got me. It's just.
He's just all misery over the Cubs.
And it's still hot in my apartment. My air conditioning hasn't been fixed. It's brutal, man.
You are struggle.
I am the absolute struggle. But that's going to wrap up Rot on God. Thanks for everybody for listening. Again, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or our email address or our phone number, 213-373-1872. And let us know if you want some more Rot on God, talk about some season arcing stuff, or if you don't. Maybe you're glad that we're not going to be filling up your podcast app feed anymore with this stuff. I don't know. Let us know what you think. Let us know what you think. We'll be back tomorrow with some more USC football. But until then,
I'm happy that UCLA won.
Sorry, I heard you.
Okay, Jake. Until then, for Jake and Elise, yeah, this is Michael, and we'll catch you guys later. See ya.
See ya.
See ya.
Hey, well, at least you have Cincinnati coming up. They suck, don't they?